Okay, there's a couple of questions. John, how to know the light has changed to nimitta? From nimitta, how to enter first jhana? Please explain. Maybe we encounter nimitta at home. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, how to know the light has changed to nimitta? So this word nimitta, technically speaking, it just means sign, as in like a signal of some sort. It's a multi-purpose word, and it can be used in many different ways. So, you know, even if you're driving your car down the street and you see a stop sign, or here in Malaysia it says berhenti on it, that's a nimitta, it's a sign. Okay? Now, oftentimes, as we meditate, there are some usable indicators that can help us gain a sense of how deep we are meditating, how well we're meditating. The other day I suggested, you know, when your mind goes totally silent and it stays silent for a long time and you feel a very deep peace, a very profound, total peace, it's at least the second jhana. So one's mind going silent, you might call that nimitta. It is something you can look to as a signal or a sign. It's like an indicator, okay? A means of indication. That's what nimitta technically means. Now, in Buddhist, you know, kind of culture, this term nimitta is oftentimes used when explaining. Sometimes people will see some kind of a light in their mind. Some kind of lightness comes up. Now, apparently not everybody will see these lights in their mind, these nimittas, before they enter a jhana. It is often the case, or even usually the case, that they will see this light before entering a jhana. But it is not like a requirement. It is not certain. It is not a prerequisite. Okay? I would even add there, it is not like you can't go so far as to assert that if there was no nimitta, you couldn't have entered a jhana. You can't assert that. And the Buddha doesn't say it anywhere in the suttas either. But it's usually the case, you know, apparently about 90-ish% of the time, according to a John Brahm. Okay, so how to know the light has changed to nimitta? Well, just be careful how you use this word nimitta. Okay, from nimitta to entering the first jhana. Now, although it doesn't really say it in the suttas, I would say from talking with other monks and also, I can't talk about my own practice here without getting in trouble, but there is oftentimes kind of this like fluttering sensation one feels on the inside as one kind of punches through to the first jhana. And again, maybe not all people experience this, but there's oftentimes a feeling inside. It's like a fluttering feeling. And that fluttering feeling is oftentimes in the below the belly button. It's in the, well, there's a word I shouldn't say, it's not a Buddhist word, but if you were to measure down from your belly button about 6 centimeters, there's a spot there. Other religious traditions have a name for this spot, but Buddhism does not give a name to this spot. You may feel a fluttering sensation in that spot as you punch through to the first jhana. To my mind, that is a... I would sooner look to that as a nimitta of the first jhana than some sort of a light. And why is that? Because there are... especially in the Visuddhimagga, but even in the early Buddhist texts a little bit, there's talk of using a so-called light nimitta, where maybe one stares at like a candle, a lit candle, or sometimes I'm sure you've seen it, it's like a white square, you know, painting, and there's like a dot of some kind, like a blue dot or a red dot or a yellow dot, different colored dots, like a big dot, and you stare at it. And this is sort of a possible kind of like way of giving yourself something easy to keep your mindfulness on. And then when you meditate, that color can come into your mind, and that too can be called animitta. But that color appearing, it's more so just like an imprint of the mind. It's not necessarily linked to entering into a jhana or a brahmavihara. You know, it's exactly like, let's say I played the video game Tetris all day long, and there was little blocks on the screen and I was playing Tetris. Then that night, when I sleep, I might have a dream of Tetris. Okay, there might be Tetris blocks in my dream. Back when I was a teenager, I played way too much Tetris. This actually happened. Sometimes I would wake up in the morning, I'm like, oh my goodness, I was playing Tetris in my dream. And so the mind can have an imprint that is sort of left on it from whatever it is we pay attention to a lot. The sutras refer to this phenomena as to extract the sign, okay? To extract the nimitta. I would suggest it's more like an imprint. It's kind of like an imprint left behind. Like maybe if there was like a little piece of Lego on the table here with the little bumps on the top, and I pushed my thumb really hard onto the bumps on the Lego. When I put my thumb away, you can see the little circles, you know, stuck into my skin. You know what I mean? It's like an imprint. But after 5 or 10 minutes, it goes away. So it's kind of like that. So these, when we use, let's say, a candle or a colored circle to help us meditate, that too can be called an nimitta. But that to my mind is, it's a little bit of a gimmick to me. It's a, some people use it. There is more of an emphasis in the commentaries to use this. I've virtually never used it, although I have had it happen to me, kind of accidentally, where like the first monastery where I lived, somebody made a very nice stained glass window, like a little, like they're like an artist who likes to work with glass, and they knew how to make their own little stained glass windows. And they made a nice little square, stained glass window, donated it to the monastery, and it got stuck to one of the windows. And it had this very nice red center, like right in the middle was a little red piece of glass. It was perfectly round. And yeah, like I sometimes I would just stop and look at it for, 5 minutes, few minutes, not even thinking, I am doing a nimitta meditation. Like I just looked at it because it was a nice piece of art. And then later on, I'd sit down in my meditation, and then that exact red color would like fill my mind automatically without me doing anything. And it was a very like rich, nice, kind of like a ruby red, like a little lighter color than ruby, but a very rich red. It was very nice. But like I wondered, like what's up with this red color? And only after a few days, I figured out, oh, I think it must have come from that stained glass window thing I was looking at. This is this kind of extracting the nimitta that they speak of in the suttas. So if you'd get a light coming up in your mind, it may be sort of like a precursor to you entering into a jhana or a brahmavihara, or it could just be this extracting the nimitta thing, which would be just more like an imprint from a piece of Lego, from whatever you looked at earlier on. I would say in any case, please do not pay attention to it, but rather continue with your object of meditation. Okay, and like if your object of meditation is breath, continue doing breath. If your object of meditation is body, continue doing body. And I would suggest whatever object of meditation you were doing preceding this light appearing, yes, it's working for you. You know, you should continue using it. You should continue like staying on target of that object of meditation. And trust that the nimitta is a secondary effect. A secondary effect. No matter how bright it gets, no matter how amazing it gets, dazzling it gets, continue doing your object of meditation. Because that's what's causing the light, okay? This is a very hard lesson to learn, by the way. What is extremely easy to get mixed up here is what the difference is between an input and an output. Your object of meditation, let's say the breath or body, that is the input. The light appearing in your mind is the output. If you focus on the output, guess what? You will make no further progress. You must instead focus on the input. And what was the input? It was your object of meditation, okay? If you can get straight what's the input and what's the output, you will make much more progress. Okay. Next question. The fourth jhana is a bliss compared to wisdom or mindfulness. What's the difference, or what's more important between wisdom or mindfulness, I guess? Is the jhana necessary for attaining sotapanna? Okay, is the jhana necessary for attaining sotapanna? This is a real tough question. There's a lot of varying opinions out there. To my mind, there's no clear answer in the suttas to answer this question. Or more accurately, you could cherry pick a number of different suttas. Cherry pick means like favor one sutta to the exclusion of every other sutta. You know, like I'm going to hold on to only this and ignore everything else on this table. I've cherry-picked it, you know. I don't care about these other things, only this thing. And it's kind of cheating to ignore everything else. So it's tempting to cherry-pick quite a few different suttas whereby you could have different positions, each different position giving a different answer to this question. So some monks or nuns or Buddhists would answer this question by saying, yes, jhana is necessary for attaining sotapanna. And they'll even go further saying, attaining jhana causes sotapanna, like directly, like A causes B. Like, you know, if I turn on the light switch, the light turns on the ceiling. It's that easy. Although I would say that is not in the suttas. To my satisfaction. Is it a contributing factor? Yes, absolutely. Is it a proximate cause? I would say yes. Proximate cause means it is a nearby cause. It is a cause, you know, a cause which precedes it by just a small amount. It is nearby to attaining sotapanna. But it's, to my mind, it's not like flicking on a light switch and now the light's on. And, you know, you are a sotapanna guaranteed. And the reason I say that is, a week from now, you might have a bad breach of sila. And then, you know, everyone around you be like, well, this person can't even be so much as a sotapanna. Look at how they still, let's say, tell a lie, or they still swat a mosquito, or they still do this or that, you know, thing which sotapannas would never do. Okay? So how good your sila is a different skill than your meditation skill. They're somewhat related, but they are different skills, I say. Poor sila will make your meditation also not very good. In that way, they are connected. Yeah, so I would say to attain sotapanna, start with sila. Get sila straight. There's no monk or nun I'm aware of who would be willing to grant that you are a sotapanna if they observe your behavior and find that it's still poor sila. Okay? There's nobody I'm aware of who still has poor sila but gets to enjoy the status of a sotapanna. Nobody. Okay, I promise nobody's going to agree you're a sotapanna if your sila is not well established, well developed, solid, you know, darn good, okay? Maybe not like utterly impeccable, but darn good. Okay, is the jhana necessary for attaining sotapanna? Yeah, have I answered that? I would say it is a proximate cause. But it is not like flicking on a light switch. No, it's not a cause like that. Now, there is that outlier sutta. Remember I stated it the other day. It's the Kali Goda one. The outlier sutta where... there's two of them, but I read one of them to you. Where... the Buddha does say you can attain to sotapanna if you have confirmed faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and you're also a profuse giver, like extremely generous, extremely, you know, devoted to acts of generosity. That's an outlier where sila didn't get mentioned, and the jhanas don't get mentioned either. So there is that outlier. So there's quite a few Sri Lankan monks I met who would cherry pick those two suttas and be like, oh, look, you don't even need jhanas. You don't even need sila either. You just need faith and generosity. Okay, so there's a lot of confusion in the world of Buddhism which results from doing this cherry picking. So just watch out for that. Cherry-picking means, again, you know, selecting on just one or two outlier, you know, rare suttas. And then saying like, oh, you know, since it says it here, I get to ignore everything else on this table. I'm just going to cherry-pick this. Yeah, lots of trouble comes from that. And then all the other monks and nuns are like, look, you ignored that, you ignored this, you ignored this. You got to take it all together. You know, when something is an outlier, we have to acknowledge that. You know, it's, yes, you found something, but don't place a bunch of emphasis and gravity on it when you know, maybe there's 30 suttas which might say the opposite thing. You know, you found one or two that say this thing, but there's 30 suttas over here that say the opposite thing or something different. There's a sense of the weightiness of different teachings based upon how often they appear. And it takes quite a while. It takes years to read the suttas and gain a sense of how often things appear. How, you know, which themes are the bigger themes, which themes are the smaller themes.